Today's lecture is going to be, as we move forward, on what makes Christian ethics unique. What makes Christian ethics different from many other forms of ethical considerations, studies? So I want to set before you certain kinds of non-Christian ethics, and then we'll compare those non-Christian forms of ethics with decidedly, distinctly Christian ethics. So why would there even be non-Christian approaches to this subject? I think the answer to that is something we considered last week. Every human being has a certain fundamental moral sense. Everybody has an awareness that there is something that is right and true and good. There's something that is just the opposite of that. We call that a conscience, right? Everybody has a conscience. And non-Christians, as well as Christians, have realized that giving some thought to the subject of right from wrong would be very beneficial, especially if you're going to live with anybody else. You know, if you're all by yourself on a desert island, it might not be quite as urgent that you think through the difference between right and wrong if you're not a Christian. But as soon as you're living with other human beings, in many cases in your own house, but certainly in larger communities and so on, as soon as you're living with other people, everybody's sense of right and wrong requires some kind of thought in order to just get along. That's why there's non-Christian ethics. That's why ethics is not just an interest for the people of God. Many, many, many people throughout the history of the world have recognized that societies would be better off if we could agree, at least to some measure, about the difference between right and wrong. So, how non-Christians have gone about defining right from wrong differs pretty dramatically. I'm going to give you three schools of thought. The first is called existentialism. Big words today, but I think I can make these fairly understandable. Existentialism, you should think of a man named John Paul Sartre. If any of you have studied French, I'd be glad to be corrected in my pronunciation. John Paul Sartre, a French philosopher, if you care, 1905 is when he was born. And when you think of existentialism, you can also think of something you perhaps heard about, a school of thought some have called postmodernism. It's a prevailing way of thinking in our day. Here's what you should understand about existentialism as they approach the subject of ethics. The most important factor in deciding how you act, according to an existentialist, is your own existence. Ta-da! In an existentialist way of thinking, God doesn't exist. Or if he does, we don't have a clue what he's like, because he's certainly not said anything to us. And because of that, there's no catalog, there's no divine Wikipedia where you can go and discern what's right from wrong. We exist as creatures with the ability to choose right from wrong. And here's the rub. For an existentialist, something is right if it's something that you want. To say something is wrong, if you say to your friend, "I think what you're doing is wrong," to an existentialist, all you're doing is expressing opinion. You don't like that.
think that you should talk to your mom that way. That's wrong to an existentialist. All you're doing is expressing your preference that they not behave a certain way. Because the ultimate determination for what is right is your own existence and who you are, what kind of person you are. So there's a standard. This is going to be an important thing with each of these schools of thought. There's a standard for morality. And that standard for morality is you. Who you are, what you are like. Sometimes people in this school of thought will say something is right if it is true to who you are. Who does that? It's true, or it's right, rather, if it's true to who you are. If you want to use some more psycho terms, you could say it's right if it actualizes your true self. Yes?
Does that sound the same thing like follow your heart, and that means that following your heart is good?
Yeah, perfect. So you've already anticipated where I'm going to go. Existentialism is all over the place in popular society. And it's expressed exactly in those kinds of ways. I'm not sure. I'm in love. Oh, guys, I'm in love. She's beautiful. She has such a great sense of humor. We have such a perfect fit. And I think I'm going to marry her, but I'm already married. And I think what I need to do is follow my heart in this. You see what I just did? My decision to divorce my wife and marry this other woman because we just sort of had this chemistry. Oh my. Every time, or 1,000 times a day, people are making decisions and even giving counsel to other people based on an existentialist ethic. If it's true to who you are, if it most actualizes you, then it is right. There's a song that's probably not popular in your day, but it was in my day. How can it be wrong if it feels so right? Well, that's a rhetorical question, and the answer is it can't be wrong. It's not wrong. If it feels right, it's right. Have you ever had somebody in a debate? Oh, I know you guys did debates about right and wrong. Have you ever had anybody try to kind of shut the whole thing down and basically say, I'm done talking about this by saying, look, it may be wrong for you, it's not wrong for me. Or, conversely, it may be right for you, it's not right for me. That's an appeal, whether they may have never even heard this word before. It's an appeal to that way of thinking of ethics. Thank you, Jean-Paul Sartre. Who are you to tell me what to do? I know you probably said that. Now, there's probably all kinds of reasons for saying that. If it's your little brother, okay, there might be something in there. He's not your moral guide in life. But sometimes when people say, who are you to tell me what to do, what they're really appealing to is this idea that the standard of morality is moi. It's myself, me. Thank you. So don't talk to me about what's right for me. All right? So this sounds familiar, doesn't it? The existentialist ethic. Now, I've said to you that it's everywhere. You'll trip over it. Probably before you get to lunch. It has a way of affecting Christians because it's the air we breathe. However, I do want you to know that among those who devote themselves to the study of ethics, this is not a school of thought that has gained the majority of adherents among those who are so-called ethicists. Now, that may change. It may be changing even as I
speak in 2016, but there's one particularly obvious reason why this wouldn't become a school of thought for a whole society to embrace. Can anybody think what that might be? Amanda?
Nobody's agreeing on anything. It said that it would be better, it's better for a society if we can agree about right and wrong, but everybody's deciding stuff. I'm like, if what's right for me is to kill Hannah, then, I mean, that might be wrong for Hannah's eyes, but I don't care.
What if you have fundamental homicidal tendencies, Amanda? That's who you are. And to actualize the true Amanda involves killing someone, then no one can say that's wrong. But everybody realizes that that doesn't make for a very orderly society. If I'm a kleptomaniac, that's basic to who I am, then you can't tell me I can't take your stuff. Because I'm just actualizing my true self. That becomes a bit problematic. If I'm a pyromaniac and I want to set your house on fire, then there's actually, in existentialism, pure existentialism, there's nothing to say that that's wrong, because that's consistent with who I am. So, yes,
Amanda? Is that why, kind of like our culture, you can do whatever you want as long as it doesn't hurt anyone?
You are anticipating number two. I'm going to give you another school of thought that does a little bit better than existentialism. Before I leave existentialism, let me just say to you that this is a form of radical moral relativism. It's the most radical kind of relativism there is. Relativism in the area of ethics is there is no objective and fixed and unchanging standard of right and wrong. It's entirely relative to who the individual is. And existentialism is the most radical form of relativism. Existentialism denies that there's actually the possibility of making an ethical judgment outside of yourself. So there's another school of thought that is kind of wise to the problems of existentialism. And we're going to call that, number two, something called utilitarianism. Sorry, another big word, if nothing else. You'll be able to throw around some big words after today's class. Utilitarianism, and if you'd like to think of someone named John Stuart Mill. And if you're interested, he was born in 1806. We're going back in time. John Stuart Mill was a Brit. The existentialist Sartre was obviously a Frenchman. John Stuart Mill was a Brit. And he wanted to make a case for something a little bit less subjective as a standard for morality than just the individual's personal identity and existence. Utilitarians recognize that a society needs some kind of standard that's bigger than the individual. Some standard bigger than any one of us by which behavior can be judged. So here's the standard for morality in the utilitarian mind. The standard for morality is the outcome of the deed. The outcome of the deed. It is right or wrong dependent on what happens when you do it. That's where it gets its name, utilitarian. That's a utilitarian view. Utility is the usefulness of something. And a deed is right if it is useful. Well, what way? What kind of outcome? Well, the outcome that determines that something is right is that it produces happiness. That's the general consensus of the utilitarian school of thought. If something produces happiness, it's right. Yes,
yeah. So say you go steal bread from a bread shop and give it to poor people, then sad people over here, but then there are happy people over here.
All right, so utilitarian typically is not thinking, when he thinks of happiness, as the measure of whether something is good in individual categories. He recognizes that's chaos. That's what the existentialist problem. So for the utilitarian, the happiness that he's making the standard of morality is the greatest good or the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. The greatest good for the greatest number of people. That's the utilitarian standard of morality. The greatest good for the greatest number of people. You guys heard that I was repeating that, right? That makes it really important. All right. So utilitarians are thinking bigger than the individual level. They're asking the question, what will bring about for a society the greatest good for the greatest number? And as we study that, if we're interested in ethics, we study what kinds of deeds bring about the maximum happiness to the maximum number of people. That's how we find out what's good. Now, that, likewise, is a way of thinking that is very prevalent in our day. Existentialism and utilitarianism sort of blend together, without the big words, in all kinds of ways that people talk and think. If you are at all listening to things in the news and listening to how politicians, for example, and other kinds of celebrity types declare their positions on things, they will frequently make reference to the fact that the majority of people, for example, today, are okay with same-sex marriage. As if to say, that is relevant to whether it's right or wrong. Now watch this. Watch this. In radical existentialism, it could be right for one individual and wrong for the guy sitting right next to it. Remember, that was radical moral relativism? But with utilitarianism, it's a bigger view. It's what makes a whole society happy. So let's say, Luke, that back in the 1920s, American society, very much by vast majority, would not have been happy with same-sex marriage. Okay, so same-sex marriage is wrong in 1920. But if in 2020 or 2015, the majority of Americans would actually be happiest with a society that approves of same-sex marriage, then what the utilitarian says is, it's right in 2015 or 2020. What was wrong in 1920 is right in 2020. Did you get that? So what utilitarians have done is they have tried to be more collective and corporate, if you will, community-minded. It's not what makes you happy. It's what makes the greatest number of people happy. But it's still fundamentally committed to a moral relativism. Do you see that? It's just a relativism that's one society compared to another society, or one society in one time of its life and another, and that same society in a later time of its life. Yes?
So, how, you keep talking about it as a society, so how do you define a society? Like, could I define this class as a society? Because if so, you can pretty much, as long as you can define what a society is, you can do whatever you want.
Utilitarianism, that's a very good question, Dale. Utilitarianism works great in democracies. Because in democracies, everybody goes to the polls, or at least is allowed to, unless they're felons or minors. Everybody goes to the polls, and they determine what's right. Chink, 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 chink. Proposition 8 in California on the homosexual issue and gay marriage and so on. In democratic society, you actually have a mechanism for the whole nation taking part in the public life of the nation in something called voting. And it's even better in a modern democratic society where you have polls. Politicians can listen to Gallup polls that indicate that now some 59% are in favor of X or Y. Abortion, for example, we are able to track pretty precisely the opinions of the American people on such abortion. Isn't that remarkable? You know, if you were in the old days, you lived in a benevolent or not so benevolent totalitarian regime, not only does it not matter what the larger population thinks, but no one's actually even consulting them. You don't even know necessarily, right? But utilitarianism is perfectly matched to a democratic society that popularly elects and popularly expresses itself in polls and all the rest. And politicians run for their office trying to please who? Of majority, that's right. At least 50% plus one, because that's how you get elected, right? What are some other problems as I've articulated utilitarianism? The standard is the greatest number, is the outcome to be specifically, but more broadly, the greatest good to the greatest number. Yeah?
One thing I noticed is I took logic last year, and this entire way of thinking is a logical flaw.
How's that?
Because you cannot, just because the majority says that something is good doesn't make it actually good, and by saying that it is a logical flaw, you cannot think that way and actually function.
All right, but we're asking the question, why, if we're actually talking not so much here about a logical argument as a definition. They're defining right and wrong. Yeah, we can argue about definitions. They're defining the standard morality as what makes the largest number of people happy. What we're doing is, inevitably, is we're critiquing that as Christians. For example, we could ask the utilitarian, well, why should pleasure be the ultimate standard for what is right? That's not necessarily the only good that, that a society would pursue. Some would stipulate that long life, it's better to live a long time than to live happy. So whatever preserves life at all costs, that's the standard right. Why would happiness be? Yes, Hannah? I'm sorry? So I sure hope you are. I'm encouraging us, yes, to do just what you're about to do, to critique this from your perspective, which is a biblical one. Go ahead.
So, it says in the Bible, in 1 Corinthians, about how because they didn't accept God, he is over themselves, and then maybe I'm thinking some passage too, about God used what is foolish to the world to shame the wise and all that kind of thing. So, this wouldn't.
All right. That's excellent. You as a Christian have, if you're a thoughtful Christian, you know your Bible, you've had programmed into you the majority is not always right. They're frequently wrong because of the little thing we call sin. Strider?
I feel like if you're looking from a biblical perspective, which we are, then there's a lot of ways to critique this. But then, if we talk about this, you know, in a democracy, since, you know, our country is, you know, obviously, we're not really a Christian. Right. We were set up in a Christian nation, but today, you know, it's not, and they don't form the laws based on the Bible, which is different because, you know, it's a separation of church and state. So, what I'm saying is there are some benefits to this as far as the government goes. Not from a Christian perspective, but there are things that we can't make all of our laws for the country based on the Bible, just because that's just not how our country works.
Well, you're exactly right. It's not how our country works. So the way our country works is, I would suggest, it's fundamentally a utilitarian view that governs our leaders. And so if our leaders start out their political career saying, I'm against, I keep using this because it's in the news right now, I'm against same-sex marriage, they'll sometimes justify the change because the American people are changing in their perspective. And the question of whether or not the United States could be governed by the law of God or the Bible, that's a fascinating question. I think nations in the history of the church
or of the world have sought to do that far more than we are today. Yeah, but it's certainly not the way we're set up now. That's not the way culture is or society is. Feeling the Bible is kind of, it's a non-starter in our society. You're right. Amen.
When all the minorities get squished, and like, I know minorities are a hot topic today, so were we more utilitarianism like in the past, and now we're kind of moving a little more towards existentialism, because now it's more like whoever's the loudest gets.
Very interesting. Amanda's raising the question, all right, the greatest good or the greatest happiness for the greatest number. What if the greatest happiness for the clear majority of Americans would be to ethnically cleanse a minority, send them to camps, extermination camps, or just slaughter them like has happened in various times in world history? Majority says life would be better for us. We would be happier. Greatest number, greatest good, greatest number, right? If this minority didn't exist anymore. Utilitarian ethic? Check. It would be right for them all to be gassed. Actually, the utilitarian ethic also works very well with the totalitarian regime. It works, it can be an expression of the worst kind of tyranny, a utilitarian ethic. Well done, you guys are anticipating many of the criticisms, and there are more. Utilitarianism is simply a seemingly more sophisticated form of moral relativism. Okay?
Well, also, can you not always predict how exactly the outcome is going to happen? You know? So, like, if you're doing something, you might say, you know, I don't know, it'll cause happiness for 49% of people. You know, like, you can't always be that precise, and you're like, oh, no, it did 51. Oh, man.
So Nathaniel is phrasing the question, how in the world, what kind of equation or calculus or combination of math and polling would actually get you this maximum good for the maximum number of people? Isn't that something that only God could know? How would we ever measure that? And how would we ever measure it objectively? Truly, yeah. So this begins to fall apart, even though it's very, very appealing to many in our day. If you ever hear somebody making an appeal to opinion polls as they argue for something being right or wrong, you should have alarms going off in your head. That has absolutely nothing to do with right or wrong unless you're a utilitarian. Or if you, how about this, guys? If you ever hear somebody say, I don't personally approve of such and such, polygamy, for example. I don't personally approve of that, but as long as everybody is happy and they're not hurting anybody, I'm not going to object. That sounds actually very mature and wise, doesn't it? If you ever hear somebody say in a question about whether something's right or wrong, they're not really hurting anybody. What particular harm is there in it? It wasn't smoking a little marijuana. Just because it's against the law doesn't mean it's wrong. Because I'm pretty confident, I'm still posing as an arguer, right? It doesn't hurt anybody. It's, hey, some people prescribe it as medicine. That way of thinking, not hurting anybody, very subtly but profoundly reveals this particular kind of ethic. Ethics are determined by the standard of happiness rather than some out external standard. All right, we need to move on. This is the biggest word yet, deontologicalism. Sorry. I used to try to call it something else, but this is actually what this particular school of thought is. And now we're going back even further to a man named Immanuel Kant.
First guy was French, the second guy was British, the third guy is German. Immanuel Kant. The word deontological comes from the Greek word for duty. Immanuel Kant would have rejected outright existentialism because right from wrong is not, in Kant's mind, merely an expression of our personal desires. And neither would he agree with utilitarianism, that right and wrong is defined by what gains happiness for the greatest number of people. The deontologicalists want to say that something is wrong, something is right, if it violates a universal moral principle. Deontologicalists believe in an absolute moral standard. It's something external to who you are. It's something external and above your society. Morality is transcendent. It is unchanging through time.
Could you repeat what's that? That it violates what?
I'm sorry?
Is there something that's wrong or right if it violates?
A universal moral standard. It's wrong if it violates a universal moral standard. Now, how does this feel, guys? Does this sound? Sounds a little different, doesn't it? The deontologicalist is saying, look, guys, murder is wrong even if you feel like doing it. Murder is wrong even if it makes the largest number of a society happy. Murder is wrong because murder is wrong. Even if killing the sick and wounded in a society, like some of our dystopian sci-fi stories tell us about, you can only live to a certain age and then you get killed off. Even if that would make the society as a whole, the largest number of people happy, killing the sick and the wounded is wrong. It goes against a fundamental universal principle. Now that should sound kind of refreshing to you by now. Does it? Hey, if you're going to choose among these three non-Christian approaches to ethics, hey, sign me up for deontological thinking. If I have to choose between those three, sign me up. But you can be a deontologicalist and be an atheist, or at least an agnostic. You can deny that there's a God who actually communicates with us. So here's what you need to know about the deontologicalist. He also has a standard for morality, and that standard he looks for in one of two places. That universal moral standard that I've told you about, he looks for it either in reason or in nature. So, for example, Immanuel Kant did this little thought experiment, and I think it's actually one that's familiar to you, because your mom probably did this with you. She may not have known that she was working with the Kant principle. But Immanuel Kant said, one of the principles of morality that would apply, we can just reason this out, would apply in every single situation. If there's a principle that would apply in every single situation, then that must be, rationally, a universal moral principle. So, did your mom ever say to you, look, what if everybody did that? Oh, so you wanted to go do X. What if everybody did that? Did your mom ever do that? I hope she did. That's a great line of thinking. If you take your behavior and universalize it, so everybody in the world does exactly that, what kind of world would we have? Ah, that's pretty good. Consort, see the rational process here? He's saying we can find out what right is and what wrong is by doing this thought experiment. What if we universalized it and everybody on the planet did that? Your mom was using a Kantian principle.
has actually got some traction to it. But of course, in doing this reasoning, not everybody will agree on the answer, will they? I think it would be fine if everybody did this, someone might say. Someone else might say, well, I don't think it would be fine. That's not the world I want to live in. The rational process is compelling, but it still runs into the fact that our reason, that this is itself fundamentally flawed. Your rationality has been broken by the fall. Sin keeps us from reasoning the way we should. But the deontologist is trying to find, first of all, a standard for morality and reason. The second standard they're trying to find is, the second source for the standard is nature. Let's just look at the world in which we live. Of course, they're not leaving the reason behind. They're doing this with their reason. But let's look at the world in which we live. And let's say, for example, that this issue of marriage, we're going to try to decide what we think about marriage, is it to be between one man and one woman and so on. Let's just look at nature. Look at mating that takes place in the animal kingdom. And that will provide some universal moral standards for us. Now you might say, yeah, I think that's actually got something to it. Mating in the natural world, male, female. Of course, there's a lot of polygamy in the natural world, right? Yes? There's a debate that I...
Particularly, I heard the example of like steam entities, and apparently they like have these... It's kind of weird, but they have, you know, like these different positions that they don't use when they're mating with females than they do when they're...
Excellent. Excellent illustration. I heard a conservative Republican gay man arguing for so-called gay marriage, and he made appeals to that. Natural world. There are multi-sex plants. There are sex-changing fish. And I'm sure we could add, there's a lot of interesting things in the natural order. For example, you might want to make the argument that parents should be kind and nurturing to their children, because that's universally found in the natural world, right? Oh, wait, no. No. Some spiders eat their spouses. Ah, ow. I don't want to use that one, do I? In my, forming my ethical. And yeah, eating young. I can, at least I can eat your young. Maybe not my own, but your young I can eat. Taking an ethic from the natural world. So we're trying to get some traction in the deontological world. We want a universal moral standard, right? We don't want it to be limited to the individual or even to the society. We want something transcendent. Can you hear the hunger here? I want to have something I can sink my teeth into, something that gives a fixed, unchanging, definitive guide to distinguish right from wrong. But here's the problem. That dog won't hunt. Going to nature or reason. There is actually a lot of interesting things that both will provide, but not an ultimate answer. So thus far, I've been giving you the non-Christian approach to ethics. Now I want to go back and do what we've already begun, and I now talk to you about Christian ethics. What's unique about Christian ethics, a Christian approach to ethics? I actually want to say to you, ladies and gentlemen, that Christianity provides not only the answer to each one of these, we've been doing that along the way. That won't work. Existentialism is just radical moral relativism. It's not going to work. Utilitarianism, we talked about why that doesn't work. Here's what I want to show you. In a Christian approach to ethics, each one of these three things, these three approaches to ethics, expresses something that Christianity alone satisfies.
there's actually an element of truth in each one of these. But you can't have that desire for that element of truth satisfied except in Christianity. Let me tell you what I mean. Go back through the list again. Existentialism says it's right if it expresses who you are. The Bible's answer to that is, guess what? The problem is who you are. Right? You're a sinner. No. The standard for morality is not who you are. Your very problem is who you are. That's our answer to existentialism, but that's not our full answer. Let's keep going. What happens to Matthew when he becomes a Christian? He changes. Not all at once. We're being patient. He's changing, but we see some more stuff to come, right? And you are all in the same boat. But Christianity changes who we are. And so there is, in the gospel and in the Christian approach to this question of right or wrong, there actually is truth to saying that what is right is what's true to who you are if you are a new creature in Jesus Christ. If you have become, in the very core of your being, a new man, as Paul says. And Paul, particularly, actually talks about this. He says, I don't do what I want to do, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me? That's Romans 7 rant, right? He's saying, I'm not acting out consistent with who I've become in Christ. And for a Christian who believes in a transforming work of grace in his life, there is actually something to this. Not as God finds us. As he finds us, we're a mess. The problem is who we are. But as he transforms us, then you'll hear the Apostle Paul use logic like this. Don't do that. That's not consistent with who you are in Christ Jesus. Don't do that. We're out of time for going through all these passages, but Romans 6 is an example, or Romans 7, or 2 Corinthians 5, or Ephesians 4. Paul says, that is not the way you learn Christ, Ephesians 4:20. What he's doing in this argument, verse 20 and following, is making the appeal, live consistent with who you are in Jesus Christ. I love the fact that a Christian can say to the existentialist, you're groping for something here that only the gospel can provide you. How about utilitarianism? Utilitarianism says that something is right if it brings about the greatest happiness. Well, the Bible says, first of all, no. And then it follows up by saying, yes. The Bible's full of calls to do things that are not in themselves very happy, happy, happy. Right? Take up your cross, follow me. Pluck out your eye. Leave your father and mother. Jesus, saying new things. And the Bible's full of things, references to how sin brings a certain kind of pleasure for individuals and societies. There's a time when the greatest happiness, the greatest number, involved coliseums where men would fight other men, they didn't have a choice, they were slaves, to the death. That's barbaric, that's a violation of the sixth commandment, but it made people happy. The Bible is full of testimony that happiness is not the standard of morality, either as an individual or a society. However, the Bible also teaches that the way of holiness in the long run is the way to happiness. Huh. You be willing to give up your life, that's painful, and you'll receive it, Jesus says. The Bible's full of the talk of reward for righteousness. And that reward looks like blessing. Not necessarily immediately, not even necessarily in this life, in its fullness. But guess what, guys? When it comes back to it,
Utilitarians are on to at least something. The society that follows God's law, which is where we're going with all this, is the happiest society. That's the society that has the greatest happiness and the greatest number. Interesting. Utilitarianism are scratching an itch that can only be scratched effectively in a Christian worldview. And of course, you know what I'm going to say about deontologicalism. I want to say, buddy, you're almost there. You're right on it. But don't keep looking for the universal moral standard in nature. Don't keep looking for it in reason. Where am I going to tell the deontologicalists to look for the universal moral standard, please? Shout it out. The Bible. The B-I-B-L-E. That's right. So these are, perhaps more than anyone else among the non-Christian, they are seeking what alone the Christian worldview, the Christian approach to ethics provides. So I'd love to talk not just critically of non-Christian ethics, but in a sense, sympathetically. Guys, whether you identify with any one of these three schools, whoever you're speaking to, you're onto something. But you'll never get it. You'll never achieve what you want apart from surrender to the lawgiver who's Christ and what he says in his word. So let's spend the next few moments, talking about the word of God as a standard of Christian ethics. And this will be, if I were writing up on the board, this would be the standard of Christian ethics, the last heading for this morning. Why is the Bible our standard for ethics? Why do you all instinctively say it's the B-I-B-L-E? Well, because it is given to us precisely for that reason. Not the only reason, but it's given to us precisely for that reason. 2 Timothy 3:16. You probably memorized it. All scriptures breathed out by God, profitable for teaching, reproof, correction, for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be competent, equipped for every good, as opposed to bad, work. The Bible is given to us as our standard. And the Bible is necessary as our standard, not only because it was given to us for that very purpose, but also because God is not still revealing himself in our day as he did in other ages among other of our fathers. Ladies, I want you to imagine that you're married. You have had your first two children. Now let's just say your first child. And your husband comes to you, this godly man, and says, in my devotions today here, the Lord told me that I was to kill my son. Has it ever happened before in redemptive history? When has it happened, Luke?
Isaac.
Yes. Abraham came to his wife and said, in my devotions today, God told me that I was to sacrifice Isaac. Can you imagine that conversation with? Now, why would you have concerns about that if that happened with your husband? Well, there's all kinds of reasons, but I'm being brief here for the sake of time. You should have a concern because God no longer reveals himself in that way now that the Bible has been completed. You say, show me that in the Bible. The Bible is your standard for right and wrong because that's the completed revelation of God. How is it the standard? Ooh, this one's a little trickier. I just asked, why is the Bible our standard? How is it our standard? This is actually what's going to make the study of ethics this year so interesting, I hope, and so challenging for so many Christians. The Bible is our standard for morality, 100%, but it requires some understanding and discerning and applying. So, for example, the example I just gave, there was one guy who pleased God very much by being willing to sacrifice his son. Is that the way all of us should be willing to please God? Why would we not have that approach? You see how
ethics is going to require not just having the Bible and saying that's my standard. Ethics is going to require interpreting and applying the Bible. That's what you've been doing thus already in your Christian life. That's what you're going to do the rest of your Christian life. For example, there are certain things that godly men and women did in the Bible that are very clearly not examples for us. But you've got to have wisdom to discern the difference. Right? There's also certain commands in the Bible, we'll see more of this next week, that no longer apply to New Testament Christians. We'll come back to that next week. Huh. Alright, so there's some examples that I don't necessarily follow. There are certain commands that I don't necessarily obey. Okay, those things are going to be interesting to discern. Can you see why Christians, even devout, godly people, could actually come to some disagreements in the area of ethics? Yeah, they agree that the Bible is a standard, but how they understand and apply it can vary. Hannah? Says something about tattoos. Christians aren't agreed about how to apply that passage to the issue of modern day tattoos. You probably know some of the chat about it. We're not going to get too sidetracked on that. That's an excellent example. Or from the New Testament, the Apostle Paul lays it down multiple times in his letters to the churches in the New Testament. More than once, he gives this command: greet one another with a holy kiss. Writer. That's what Paul, the inspired apostle, said. I don't remember the last time you kissed me, Strider.
I guess it kind of depends on the culture, because maybe it just in that culture that is.
Alright.
Out of respect, then we do now.
Alright, you sure want there to be some kind of cultural thing going on there, right? I do. Because that's not my way of greeting, generally. Yeah, so there are certain commands that have cultural situatedness, that we've got to unravel. I'm going to say next week that that's a command we should be heeding, but not necessarily in its most literal expression. In the Middle East, to this day, men kiss on the cheek. In South America, as some of us went there on mission trips, we were told the culture there, men, women, in the church, you give the traditional air kiss. You know what an air kiss is? Well, if you don't actually make contact. But it's still the remnant of actually a far more historic greeting, world history all considered, than our handshake and, you know, our Western personal reserve. I actually think that the Apostle Paul's admonition, greet one another, your brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ, greet one another with a holy kiss, needs to be heeded by us, not so much literally, as what's the principle there? Warm, yes, warm, personal greeting. In the way that your culture expresses that. Yeah. And don't be reserved towards each other. So I'm trying to make the point here that how the Bible is our standard involves some thought and application, and ladies and gentlemen, that's where Christians often find themselves disagreeing on some of the details. I talked about why the Bible is our standard, how it's our standard. We'll come back to that more next week. But let me ask as we conclude, is the Bible really a sufficient standard for morality today? And it says yes. In some ways, this is an even more important question than the question, is it a standard? Is it the only standard? Here's the problem, guys. We're going to talk in this year, we're going to talk about things like birth control. Or we're going to talk about things like environmentalism. We're going to talk about pornography. There are not any, well, it's debatable, at least with regard to the second and the third, there are not any chapter and verses for those. Actually, for all three. There's no particular clear Bible verse. I'm going to actually have to tell you that if you're looking for a Bible verse that explicitly says abortion is murder, you're not going to find it. Did you know that? Yeah. So you're not going to find it. Does that mean we don't have anything to say about these modern issues because the Bible never says anything about it? No better than that. But here's what I want to be very conscious in your mind. Some of our fathers said, if the Bible's teaching by good and necessary consequence, that's an old-fashioned way of saying by logical deduction, good and necessary consequence, can be shown to oppose something, then that is as binding on a Christian as if it was spelled out. I go into somebody's dorm room, they got a Playboy pinup in their room. I say, dude, how do you square that with the seventh commandment? And he says, look, there's nothing in the Bible against pictures of pretty women without your clothes on. Nothing in the Bible about that. Pornography's not the Bible. Why is it true talk? What am I going to do? I'm going to walk them through a Christian view of sexuality, marriage, and modesty, right? And lust. And I'll say, well, not time or time. There's absolutely no room for this kind of behavior. And if you remember my church and I with other elders have authority, it goes even further than that. Eventually, if he's unrepentant, right? Pornography doesn't have to be a word of the Bible. And the phenomenon, we didn't have pixels back then, right? Texts and so on. But the Bible is sufficient. That's important for you to see. To guide us in every issue. Doesn't speak directly to it, but the principles are there for every issue in modern life. That's all I have time for today. I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts as you write them down in your essay responding to that question. Thanks for giving me the next minute. You are dismissed, ladies and gentlemen.